When I got a call saying that they were making this show that was set 200 years before Game of Thrones, I was really interested.
When I got the gig, for that split second, you're like, oh my God, you're in Game of Thrones, it's the biggest thing ever. Then you put the phone down, you're like, oh God, now I've got to do it.
Game of Thrones has such a history and a fan base and a culture that exists beyond it and around it.
It's the biggest TV show, so yeah, so there's a bit of pressure to live up to.
How do we make Thrones but not Thrones? What's good about Thrones? What worked in Thrones? What didn't? What do we want to better? How do we want to evolve the style?
It wasn't just a prequel for prequel's sake. There was actually a reason to tell the story. The Targaryens are the fascinating dynasty that we don't really know much about from the original books because at that point they've all died out. There was this once great day where there were dozens of Targaryens running around and a bunch of dragons, and they ruled over Westeros. It was a time of peace and prosperity, and everybody knew that if you messed with the Targaryens, you would get the dragons, so nobody dared to overthrow them. This period in Westeros was a very decadent time, so you get to see what the realm looks like before it descends into the detritus and post-decadence of war that you see in the original series. So I was fascinated in going back to that time and seeing the Targaryens at their height and learning what it was that Daenerys lost in trying to win back throughout the story.
The original Game of Thrones was very much an epic that was weaving together various different threads. It still has that scale and scope, but it's really just the story of one family slowly tearing itself apart.
There's a wish fulfillment for an audience of things they want to see. We're not here to not give it to them. We're here to give them the thing that they want, just not in the way that they're expecting.
We're not trying to rehash the past. We're trying to find something fresh and exciting.
We wanted to very much embrace the feel and the world of Game of Thrones, but we had the flexibility to enlarge and enhance. But there was this very strong feeling that we wanted the audience to feel they're in the same show.
The first time I walked on set where King's Landing's been built, I feel like no one told them that that isn't how films are made now, that you don't have to build the whole castle. But no, it's all there, and it's all in the right place.
You read the script at home, and you imagine the scene, and then when you come in, it's always twice the size you imagined it.
You walk around these sets that look like ancient monuments and buildings with massive statues, or you can be on these amazing locations. You cannot believe that this is on the earth somewhere this extraordinary.
The other set of Game of Thrones was absolutely brilliant, and the costumes were brilliant. So it was not a question of doing better, it was just a question of doing something beautiful.
We had said to ourselves, we're going to pull our horns in on season one. We're going to start in a more grounded, more intimate way. But even with our horns pulled in, it was just big.
One of the many beautiful things that George did with his creation of Westeros is it really feels three-dimensional and fully realized, and that there's thousands of years of history, and you can get lost in a good way in the world of Westeros.
For me, the best fiction, the best drama, is about characters. House of the Dragon is a story about very flawed human beings, capable of love and hate, capable of doing good things, capable of doing monstrous things.
I genuinely hope that audiences are open to watching a new chapter in the Game of Thrones saga.
Game of Thrones was its own thing, and it was a cultural phenomenon. But this is something else, it's a different story, the scale of the story is told in a different way.
All that size that we loved in Game of Thrones is here, but House of the Dragon is rooted in the domestic and the familial.
I hope fans will get everything that they got out of Game of Thrones and more. More dragons.
I, Corlys Velaryon.
I, Lord Hobart Hightower, promise to be faithful to King Viserys.
I swear this. By the old gods and the new.
Westeros is basically a feudal society. It's ruled by many noble houses, some of them going back hundreds or even thousands of years. Two of the biggest players are the Velaryons and the Hightowers.
The Hightowers are from a very ancient, wealthy, powerful household who have been front and center of politics for hundreds of years.
The Hightower sigil has a torch on it, and their motto is "We light the way." That comes across within the characters of the Hightowers.
Their seat of power is the southern coast, Old Town, which was for many thousands of years the biggest city in Westeros. The Faith was headquartered there for many years. That was where the High Septon, our equivalent of Pope, had his seat.
Within the series, you have old gods and new gods, and the Seven is new religiosity, and the Hightowers have a strong connection with the High Septon.
When we first opened the series, Otto Hightower is Hand of the King, and I think there's a Hightower fire there.
There's a saying, when the king eats, the hand shits. He steers the small council on the king's behalf when it's necessary and ensures the king's wishes are enforced.
Otto's an advisor, but Viserys is quite suspicious of him.
Otto sees the danger in everything, and even though his intentions are good, he's also persuaded himself that there is nothing but good intention behind his action.
The gods have yet to make a man who lacks the patience for absolute power, Your Grace.
The Valerians are of Valerian blood, from the Freehold of Valeria, the mightiest empire in the West. Destruction was coming to Valeria. The Doom, as it would later be called. And they actually arrived in Westeros before the Targaryens.
High Tide is a standalone castle belonging to Lord Corlys.
He's master of ships. He's the greatest sailor of the land. He's the one who's done these famous 9 voyages. The Valyrians control the greatest and strongest fleet.
The Sea Snake is a collector and a trophy hunter and very proud of his voyages, so he festoons his hall in all of the won objects from his 9 voyages across the Narrow Sea and beyond. The Sea Snake is the richest man in Westeros aside from the throne, but it's not quite good enough for him. He wants his blood on the throne.
He was there when Viserys was chosen as king. He felt it should have been his wife, and he's never really forgotten that.
The queen who never was. To have your husband as your champion, constantly saying, it should have been you, it should have been you, it should have been her, is fantastic. There's a classic example of a healthy, strong marriage.
The Valerians were not pleased by this, but when the realm is against you 20-1, you'd be pretty foolish to go to arms to try to press that. Jaehaerys did not want bloodshed. He wanted a smooth transition to his successor.
History does not remember blood. Remembers names.
The dragons are a power men should never have trifled with. One that brought Valyria its doom. If we don't mind our own histories, it would do the same to us.
I was fascinated in going back to that time of high decadence and peace and prosperity and seeing the Targaryens at their height.
The height of an empire usually means the height of its technology, and so we had to show this idea that this was an opulent and decadent group of people.
So you get to see what the realm looks like before it descends into the detritus and post-decadence of war that you see in the original series. Jim and his team created this really immersive environment for not only the cast, but the crew to realize this world and again, immerse people into something.
The Red Keep composite was the jewel of the whole piece for me, because that's where the bulk of the action is taking place in this season. So I introduced this big staircase as a sort of symbol of power, and that it was a sense of parliament as well as just the home of the family. And the composite also allows lots of positions to observe the little pockets of conversations that are going on, to add to the intrigue and the conspiracy that must go on all the time in those places.
It's all built in, it's not on separate stages, which was really fun to play with, and it was incredible.
Wow, I've never been on a set like the Red Keep.
Part of the discussion about the Red Keep and all of the familiar locations, particularly the familiar set, is I need to be able to shoot in every direction without it becoming a visual effect, and you can certainly do that on the Red Keep. We were 200 years in the past, and so Valyrian architecture, we wanted it to be quite brutalist quality to the Targaryens, which then found its way to King's Landing, but is not very represented in the original show.
We have utilised some of the assets from Game of Thrones, but obviously the set decorator and design team, they want to create a fresh look. It's so relatable to Game of Thrones, but it's got to be its own entity. So stuff from their archive that wasn't used that we've repurposed and turned into something.
In terms of set decorating and creating a new world almost that has some elements of Game of Thrones running through it, I've been given the opportunity to actually play with that a little bit and come up with new ideas. And that's been really exciting.
All that size that we loved in Game of Thrones is here.
Dragon Cell is one thing, but the Iron Throne is the most dangerous seat in the realm.
The throne is the big one for us on this. You know, it was very iconic in the Game of Thrones season.
You know, you wanted to make sure you're doing it justice, but also improving it and doing what we can. And Ryan and Miguel were very involved in that from day one.
I was fascinated with this idea of what if the throne had changed over time in Westeros? And what if there was a whole story to tell about the kind of devolution of the throne to the thing that you see in the original series?
This was all about the power of the Targaryen dynasty. And so every element in that throne represented a fallen warrior.
The operatic quality meant we needed to reconfigure the throne room, and as a result, the throne kind of spread out and became this carpet of swords.
One of the many beautiful things that George did with his creation of Westeros is it really is a truly immersive world, and I'm really excited for everybody to see it. One of the challenges of telling a story about a time where there's great decadence and a period of very long peace is how do you create drama out of that? And we really knew a tournament felt like a great way to do that.
May the luck of the Seven shine upon all combatants!
When I first read about the tournament, I thought, oh, it's going to be in a field with some trees around it, and maybe there'll be some flags.
I talked to the guys about the tournament very early on because I wanted to bring something stronger and more powerful to support the Targaryen dynasty.
Jim produced this drawing of basically the Colosseum, and I said, really, Jim, have you got the money to build that? And he goes, yeah. Which I should never have listened to.
As soon as we saw the mirrored half-moon shape that he did, it was glorious, and we saw a real need for it. They would, of course, have royal tournament grounds. It would be in the city, surrounded by the buildings. It just made sense.
Probably one of the biggest challenges was where do we shoot the tournament and how big do we make it and where do we build that set piece that was obviously eventually put on the back lot.
We had to make a level platform to build the set on because obviously it's on quite an incline. So we had to prepare a whole like farmer's field out there.
The difficulty there is creating a tournament that's suitable for the stunts that are going to be enacted out there.
Especially with horses, you need soft ground. You don't want the horses to hurt themselves, you don't want the stuntmen to hurt themselves. So that huge layer of mulch was there to make a soft landing.
Suddenly we have this huge stadium that we have to fill out. And of course, with all the COVID restrictions, extras only amounted to 150, and we had to look like we had 1,000.
So where we have to put crowd into a shot that doesn't have enough crowd in it, you can either go full CG or you can use sprites.
Yes, come on! That's the way to do it.
And for that, what we do, as we're shooting, we're pulling the extras away and we film the sprites from all sorts of different angles with all sorts of different actions. Cheering, crying out, sitting down, standing up, and then we literally populate them like little cards.
Good fortune to you, cousin.
I would gladly take it. I thought I needed it.
The royal box itself is this huge, great dome, which gives us a nice, intimate area for all the dialogue that goes on between all the various characters.
I wanted that to be the dominant part of the arena, and it was quite a costly thing, that box.
But I promise! You will not be disappointed!
It's the best spot to watch the jousting and to see the knights clashing in the center of the arena.
Well done. That was great.
Kings.
fire. And blood. Dreams didn't make us kings. Dragons did.
To win it. History does not remember blood. It remembers names.
I'm putting you on the spot. In 10 seconds, how many dragons from this series can you name?
Caraxes, Syrax, Tyraxes, Beleriand, but he's dead. Vhagar.
That's more than me. I forgot.
That was
all.
Really good.
I can't even name me children, so.
I had bets out there. They said 3, and you got 6.
That's
not bad, is it?
I might have added one on. So I'm going to ask another really fluffy question to get things started.
Great, love it.
The two of you could have a hair off. You both have great hair in this. Now, I notice you have more of a blunt cut. You have more of a bob. It's more neat.
Yeah.
Yours is wilder. You have a man pony happening. I'm wondering if this reflects your characters in any way, and who do you think has the better wig?
I've got a beautiful, gorgeous wig. My wig was made from the
same.
His
is more expensive.
I had the most expensive wig on the show.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's the king.
Facts.
But I've got more styles, haven't I?
I think. Well, I've got some beautiful styles, man. Let's not go into that.
Just react. It's because anyway, I don't want to give it away.
I don't know who just won.
Me?
No way. I've got.
I was the only one with the same hair palette as Daenerys.
Oh.
It was taken from her colours.
Really?
And it's all about how it matches your skin tone. It's quite a considered thing, all joking aside, your hair. Because some sort of like tones of it, they look green against your skin and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's not just like they lob a big
blonde
wig on
your head. Who do you
think
you're talking to? You're talking to an LA girl that highlights her hair every month.
I was
going to
say, that's not a wig,
days.
Is it? That's real hair, isn't it?
I wanted to ask you about riding the mechanical bull, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Which is riding a dragon.
Yeah.
If we were to have like a hidden camera on you.
Yeah.
And show the behind the scenes of what that actually looked like. Can you break it down for us? I heard there's like leaf blowers, like blowing wind.
Yeah, I mean, not leaf
blowers.
Hoovers. Got great, yeah, got some memories going at you. They've got great big wind machines like this. Rain, the lot. And you're up on a plinth, which is about 20 foot in the air. Then they strap you in. And then you can't get down. You're just up there all day. And then they sort of move you around on like a remote control mechanical bull.
Did your skills get better over the season?
No, not really. I was born to do it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, I like
it's
that.
Easy.
Cockiness.
Yeah.
Who really deserves the throne? Beginning of season one, who do we really think deserves the throne?
Me.
Him.
Well, the heir. I'm sorry. The heir to the
Me.
Throne. Why?
That was a real Beetlejuice moment.
Me. Me, I do. I do deserve it by rights.
No, he has a right. Has a right to it.
Yeah, and you nick it off me.
Yeah,
you did. You
but
stole it.
But there's no way in the seven hells that I'm going to name him heir. He's too irresponsible.
What, you don't know how I'd react to that.
Do you
know what I mean?
Every job he's had, he's ballsed up. He's made an absolute mess of. There's no way.
The question is, has he done it on purpose or has he just ballsed it up?
No, I didn't do it to hurt you or anything like that. I think that I my duty as king. I even say, I actually don't think that Daemon wants to be king.
No, I don't.
You know, the councils say, you know, they think that he's got designs on it, and I'm like, he doesn't want to be king. He could not sit in that council room without
him. He wouldn't turn up.
He'd never be there.
He's afraid of commitment.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Something like that, I think so.
Wow.
He'd be out on the merry.
George has sort of said, there's nobody really good or evil.
No.
Like Game of Thrones, there's good and evil. But who do you think is the most evil and the most good in season one? Who do you truly think? And a lot of people have been naming you as the most good.
Well, I am, yeah.
And who have they been naming as the most evil? Otto.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd go with Otto.
Do you agree?
Yeah. Because he's the most Machiavellian. He's the most serpentine.
He is, yeah.
He's the puppet master.
Yeah.
Which is why Daemon, and he says, look, I see him for what he is. He's a puppet master. He's got you like this.
Yeah.
George said real quick that the biggest conflict on this show is not between people, but within somebody's own heart. What do you think each of your characters' biggest conflict in their heart is? I'm ending things on a very deep note.
Deep one, yeah.
My biggest conflict, I should never have been named king.
God, it's a tough one.
Why?
Because really, in my heart, I wasn't built to do it.
I don't know, really. It's a tough one. His biggest conflict is himself, to be honest. And his brother. Something to do with his brother, probably.
God.
I don't know what.
It's because he should never have been king.
His brother. Well, exactly. Exactly. It's probably true.
He said it himself.
I've inherited your conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
Bastard.
If Rhaenyra comes into power, she can cut off any challenge to her succession.
I am to inherit the Iron Throne. She will block my way.
So first of all, I heard that when you two met for the first time, that you instantly were like in love. Like, was that sort of, you're nodding your head, Olivia, like, yes. Sort of, how was that first meeting between the two of you?
Lovely.
And a relief as well.
Such a relief.
Yeah. We're just like, oh,
home.
Yeah, we've got this.
Yeah.
We've got each other.
Yeah. I mean, we're f***ing lucky, actually, because it's, you know, it's that rare thing where you meet someone and there's like an immediate understanding and familiarity and that's quite unusual and...
Yeah, it is.
Deeply grateful for it.
And a lot of the time on these jobs, you're thrown together and, you know, you're expected to have this intense chemistry. And that's something that, as actors all the time, we have to work on.
Yeah.
And so it's such a treat when it's just like that.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
See you.
Yeah,
know
yeah.
You.
Oh, good.
Love
good.
You.
All right, chill. Yeah.
However, would you think Ryan was nervous when he saw how well you got on? Because later on, they're sort of... divided.
I hope he was nervous.
Yeah.
No, well, but I mean, crucially, this story is like that connection and that chemistry is sort of fundamental to anything that happens later. And ultimately, you have two people who desperately want that reunification. Mm. Won't ask for it. But so that
love,
that we like each other, it's really handy. Actually.
Yeah, that love has to be cemented already to then hate each other.
And that's where the pain is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without the love, the pain doesn't work.
Right.
So.
Emma, for you, I want you to juxtapose for me, because I heard about your audition that your phone was propped up on a chip bag and that you sort of had to makeshift some hair extensions.
Yeah.
So juxtapose that from the first time you stepped on the set, full wig, full like 2,000 crew and cast.
Yeah.
How big a difference were those two worlds?
I mean, like, I don't even really have language to describe that. Added to which, we come into this on the back of a pandemic where I haven't seen anyone in 2 years. I mean, like different worlds. Mm. And certainly initially, I felt like I'd won a competition. And that someone had, but like, it's very weird to be plucked out your living room, right?
Yeah,
because it's
true.
Also like, you know, so little during a pandemic could be in person.
Anyone. Yeah.
So again, there's something very surreal about going from, doing tapes in your bedroom to arriving on set with 2,000 people, you know, whatever it is, 600 people. And then, of course, in like no time, it becomes wonderfully familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know,
very
that's
normal.
The joy of it.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Boring.
Yeah.
I'm bored.
Bored now.
Untrue.
So I know that you hadn't watched Game of Thrones before you were cast. So then how did you infuse it? Did you binge, like, when you got the role, did you just, like, go hard? And what were your thoughts?
So I'm so glad I hadn't watched Game of Thrones before I auditioned, because I think if I had the feelings towards Game of Thrones that I have now, I wouldn't have gotten the role, because I love it so much and I think it's so incredible. And our director, showrunner, Miguel Sapochnik, who directed episodes like Hard Home and Battle of the Bastards, and he's just incredible. He's the one that has like shaped this the House of the Dragon. So it you know, that was one of our biggest that was one of our biggest turn-ons. That was one of the things that was
I was turned on.
I was turned on. Yeah. We were all turned on. Yeah. That was one of the things that made us want to do the job, you know, from the get-go. What was the question? I'm so sorry.
No, you answered it.
Did I? Oh, good.
But I get turned on watching the show, and I don't know if that's good or bad. But
I mean, it's a sexy show.
It's
just a reality.
Yeah, it's a sexy show.
It's visceral. It's in your face. So yeah.
Yeah, but no, loved it. And me and my mum binged it together, and she's on my same like Now TV account, which is what Thrones is on in the UK. And she would be like 4 or 5 ahead of me, and so I'd just click on it and be like, "What's going on?" And then something would happen. And I'd be like,
I'm wondering for the two of you, because you have your characters have very different relationships with their father. And I think maybe it changes, it's sort of part of maybe the reason why they end up conflicted with each other. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you think those relationships differ?
Yeah, I mean, so for Rhaenyra, like, she adores her dad. And he adores her. And simultaneously, they share a stubbornness that means they just can't communicate. I think there is like a really genuine love there. And I don't think you talk often about Otto making a pawn of Alicent. I think that's true with Viserys.
No.
And yet, somehow he completely isolates her by not being able to communicate. And she wants his sort of adoration more than anyone and can't ask for it. So they're at an impasse. Whereas you kind of, you do talk.
Yeah, I feel like for me, like, you've been granted maybe too much freedom, where you'd love some boundaries set. And whereas my relationship with my dad, it's been imposed upon me that I will live a life of servitude, you know?
Deeply restrictive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your characters have been compared to Cersei and Arya. Do you think it's a fair comparison? Because I feel like with your character, she was sort of portrayed as a pure villain from the narrative in the book, but maybe that we'll see a different side, but do you think those are fair comparisons?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like archetypes, for sure, but they do feel very different as well. And the beauty of Game of Thrones is that one minute you love these characters and the next you absolutely despise them. And I don't think that's that different for us.
No. And like, if anything, what I would hope is that House of the Dragon has really, really worked to make sure that, like, as in life, you don't have like goodies and baddies. Everyone's a mix, and kind of that's what makes life so threatening, I think. Mm.
Do you think the realm will ever accept me as their queen?
The lords of the realm bent the knee.
A woman would not inherit the Iron Throne.
Because that is the order of things.
So first of all, congratulations on the series. Ryan, I want to know if you felt a little bit like you sat on the Iron Throne yourself when George R.R. Martin named you king of this empire.
That's a really good metaphor. I think it felt very much like that. And then I was wondering if that meant that sitting there meant that everybody was then going to try to kill me.
That's an interesting. I'm not going to even say anything to that, other than the fact that what was that? Because I know you had a lunch with George R. R. Martin where you sat down, and it was the next day that your agent got that call saying, you know, George has a job for you. What did you say to him in that lunch? What happened behind the scenes that you had such a kinship with him?
It was, well, we had developed a relationship over a few years, just as me as a fan. I got to know him, and we became friendly, and it was just nice. I mean, he was hugely influential on me as a writer, and I was just a big fan of his. So I never expected anything out of the relationship at all, and I honestly thought I was just going out for a beer with him, and he had come in with an agenda. And that was to try to get me to write this pilot, which of course I leapt at the chance. And it really, I mean, it came together in such, things in this town did not fall out of the sky like that ever, especially good jobs. So it was, I'm still stunned by how it all happened, but it felt, you know, it felt like a bit of like Daenerys seeing the, seeing the red comet in the sky. It was a prophecy of things to come.
Miguel, they had to drag you back kicking and screaming, from what I heard, after 11 weeks of night shoots on Game of Thrones. You're an Emmy winner, though, for your work on that show. One thing that I think fans are really excited about is 17 dragons. I know we don't even see them all in season one, but sort of tell me sort of what went into, how do you decide what dragons are going to have what personalities? How much fun is that? And
they look, from what I've seen in episode one, spectacular.
Thank you. The dragon process was really, I think we spent over a year designing 13 of the dragons. And it was really interesting. We learned a lot about dragons. We had to figure out things like why dragons die, for example. You know, what kills a dragon? Because it seems to be that there was certain mythology that hadn't been kind of filled out by George. So it was quite fun to kind of look for the pieces and try and figure out how do we tell a story so that we retrofit our designs into this mythology about dragons. And then there was the reality of, like, you know, you can design a dragon all you want, and then you give it to these guys called the riggers, and the riggers basically take your dragon design, they break it down, build a skeleton, put the muscles on it, and then try and figure out why it doesn't fly. And so there was a lot of, you know, Caraxes, which is the bloodworm, which is Daemon's dragon, is a dragon that's super long. He's basically a deformed dragon. We call him the Elephant Man. And the funny thing about Caraxes is Caraxes really shouldn't fly because his body's too long for any aerodynamics to work properly. And so it was going back and saying, oh, we've got to put little kind of wings in his hind legs for this to actually work. That kind of stuff is pretty fun to do, but they're not real. You know that, right?
What are you talking about?
Sorry. I won't spoil it for you.
I think I might cry. How could you do this to me? Ryan, I can't even imagine. I know you're a prop collector. You even have a podcast about movie paraphernalia. So I'm wondering, for you, working on the Iron Throne, some of the incredible daggers, and this is also the height of the Targaryen dynasty. Can you talk about, from the scope of it to the big things to like those little details, kind of the undertaking of this project, and how do you make sure it fits in with what we're going to see 200 years later when we see familiar sets?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the great fun of doing something like this, where the entire world is bespoke or custom. You know, everything has to be built and constructed, and it's all done with a purpose and a design behind it. And you get all of these wonderful artisans from all corners who are, that their entire focus is creating this little piece of parchment or this dragon's egg, or dragon's eggs need to be kept warm. How do we keep them warm? There should be a carrier. There should be some kind of kiln to carry it around in. And you get all of this creativity that comes to you from the outside, just based on people wanting to make the world feel like a real place that's lived in. And you get to see all of these. You know, Jim Clay, our production designer, said something really interesting to me when we were right at the outset. He said, the film business in general just employs all of these crafts that would otherwise be extinct. You know, clay sculptors and plasterers, and yes, you could do that as an art form on the side or have a little Etsy shop, but in terms of it being a reliable career and a trade to learn and study and grow in and have some kind of career path for you, it's really a lot of those handmade old things that we used to do before machines took over everything are employed by the film industry, and you get artists that pursue that. So just that's one of the joys for me, is because I can't do it. I have one life skill. And if anybody ever, if AI takes over writing, I'm really screwed because I can't do anything else. Miguel is very talented. He can draw. He's good at music. I can do one thing. So just for me, just getting to watch all of those people do their job is one of the greatest joys of my job.
The wrap and be, but real quick. If I'm going to be a prophet for a second, I think you guys have said you already know how this is going to end. Approximately how many seasons the Baratheons and the Starks are teased in you know, one of the teasers, and then we expect kills from Game of Thrones. Is that mapped out in your brains, or is a lot of it still in flux? Until I know the books have been written, but in terms of how it's all going to play out,
we have a plan.
It's only one season long. Sorry, I've got to tell you now. It's just like it's over after one season. We're going to have like two episodes next season, but they'll be extremely long, about 5 hours each, and that's going to be it.
No, we do have a plan. I mean, the beautiful thing is that the dynasty has, you know, 100 years left in it, even after the Dance of the Dragon. So there's plenty of places to go kind of before and after, but this story has a defined length to it simply because of how bloody it is. And we kind of have that in our head, but I think the hope is that there'll be an appetite for more Targaryen tales, because I think it's interesting to go backwards and forwards in time and tell tales from, you know, before the conquest, and then possibly a time when they were in power but with no dragons. I think there's a lot of interesting themes and landscapes to explore within that 300-year dynasty.
Well, who else would have a claim?
The firstborn child.
Rhaenyra. No queen has ever sat the Iron Throne.
The king has an heir, Daemon Targaryen.
I will not be made to choose between my brother and my daughter.
Okay, first I have to ask you.
Yes.
You have a joust.
Yes.
And then you have a flirt.
Yes.
Who flirts after they joust?
Kristen Cole.
Christmas came early.
I don't know. I don't know how he did that. Yeah, it was weird thinking about it. I don't know that I would have the energy to kind of go.
I think
flirt.
That it's a move, because it's like I just beat your uncle. So.
Yeah, in this fight. Yeah. And he's the best.
And he's the best.
So. I mean, Damon.
And it was just so easy.
The fight?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it was so easy. I have energy to now.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it wasn't easy for me at all.
No.
I was exhausted.
Were you?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
It was you're throwing a ball with sticks on it, on a chain. It's kind of made of plastic, but it's still kind of...
It's got weight to it.
So that it does a thing. And also it rebounds off the shield. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but there are areas... in which you don't want a ball with spikes to rebound and hit.
No.
So a lot of it was kind of, like you're going to really be good with your hips. So I did a lot of hip work.
Did a lot of hip action.
Yeah.
Riding dragons, more difficult? Are you?
Oh, no. Actually, no, so easy. Much easier.
Oh, it is? Yeah. Okay.
Mate, you're just kind of like propped up on this like basically like saddle, and they just kind of move you around. That's it. I didn't have to train like Fab had to train and everything. No, actually quite simple.
Yeah. I asked
Matt. But you did have to do High Valyrian.
I did have to do High Valyrian, which is...
Okay, so that balances it out.
You asked Matt.
I asked Matt, like, if there was, like, a hidden camera on each of you riding a dragon, like, who, like, what would it look like? Would you look ridiculous? Because there's a leaf blower.
I mean, it's quite easy for me to look ridiculous. So, yeah. Yeah. I look ridiculous.
What did Matt say?
What did Matt say?
He basically said, I said, did you get better over the season? He says, no, I was born to do it.
Oh, that is such an MS answer. So smug.
So smug.
So smug.
I love him.
I was born to it, darling.
Born to it, darling.
Darling.
So I've been asking everybody today, like, there's really no good or evil in this show.
No.
Who, in your opinion, though, in your personal opinion, is the most evil and the most good in season one?
I think Rhaenyra is the most good. And I think the most evil... Ooh. Matt Smith.
Actually, yeah.
Matt Smith, not the character.
Sorry,
<David.
laughs> No, sorry. Daemon Targaryen.
Daemon Targaryen is a
lovely man. Daemon Targaryen, yeah.
And David's character.
David Horovitz. Oh my god, I take it back. David Horovitz is the best character ever. David Horovitz, I love him. I think about him all the time.
Oh,
we're on a group text about insomnia. Me and David. I've texted him almost every single day for the last 6 months. I swear to God.
Does the cast have group texts?
We have some group texts.
Do you?
Yeah,
tell
we have some group
that.
Chats.
We can't spread
anything about. There are a few group chats. One started that was a disaster. It started at the beginning and it lasted maybe 3 days. And then there's another one that I'm on.
It was very popular.
That's not true.
It is
true. Yes, we have. I can't share
it's
the
just
content.
Us complaining.
It's us complaining.
It's literally just us
complaining. Or someone going like, do you know what the crafties have got on? Does anyone know? Does anyone know if there are burritos at crafties?
What is this smoothie
today? Why does my rice look like that?
Were there burritos back then?
Yeah.
Will a burrito make its way onto set?
Yeah,
that's a reference to it.
Those are the kind of questions.
Jakar, you had to see sort of the famous line of Jakaris in episode one.
Yeah.
Sort of how epic was that for you?
I mean,
it was pretty
epic. I remember reading it and being like, that's the line. I mean, she doesn't want to say it in the scene that she has to say it, which is kind of what is so heartbreaking about it. But no, I feel very like, it was very surreal to say such an iconic line in such an iconic context.
Yeah. Can you tease? I mean, this I sort of know because of the books. I know a little bit about this relationship that sort of starts to unfold. Can you tease a little bit about?
We can't. We can.
We have a.
We can show you. We can show you.
Okay.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Kristen Cole.
Rhaenyra, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
That's it.
That's it.
That's all. That's what it is.
That's
kind of perfect.
That's all we have.
Yeah, I think it's good. Yeah.
Rhaenyra's succession will be challenged. Knives will come out.
You are the king. Your first duty is to take a new wife.
So let's talk about this power couple on the show. Are you two the biggest power couple?
Yes.
Yes.
Why?
Wow.
We're badass.
We're badass. We're the richest. And she's incredibly smart, incredibly politically astute. And when he's, you know, got his sense around him, he listens to her.
I think the thing about us as well is that we're probably the two people in the court. Well, and the, I suppose Damon as well, because he's a sort of live wire and nobody quite...
Mm. Damon, yeah.
He's sort of dynamite. But nobody wants to mess with us.
Mm. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Because
we also control the Navy, because we are seafarers. And so the realm's Navy is basically our Navy. Mm. So, yeah. And we don't really care how people think about us.
Interesting. I find it interesting because you were, of course, I don't even want to say it, but the queen that never was. And then you're also the wealthiest. You've traveled the most. You're the most worldly. So how do the two of you reconcile not being at the top?
I don't know that they
don't think they have reconciled.
No, I don't think he certainly hasn't.
And I don't think she has either. I think she's way better at covering it because she's such a good politician. She's superb at appearing that everything's okay.
Mm. Whereas he's not so much. He's just like, no, shut me up! You know, so I don't know that they...
I love that.
Yeah, me too. I actually quite like that about him, that he's so...
He's so macho.
Macho, and so taking on the insult to his wife.
It's great. I feel very protected by you.
Yes, yeah. You should. Yeah. So I'm not sure that they have reconciled. But
yes, no reconciliation.
Yeah. It's bubbling underneath.
Yeah, and I think an awful lot of the motivation for the season is him trying to find ways to get them.
Yeah.
Either to the top or better access to the top.
And I think the journey that they both go on is quite interesting. It's like they end up slightly in the opposite places.
Yes.
To begin with in the way
I want to talk about this delicious line that you get to say that is in the trailer, so I'm not spoiling anything, but men would sooner put the realm to the torch than see a woman ascend the Iron Throne. How delicious was it to say it? Such great dialogue. It's also foreshadowing a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I was hooked into the show when I first met Ryan and Miguel, and Miguel said, the whole sort of arc of this story, of this particular story, is based around this line, which is that men would sooner put the realm to the torch than see a woman ascend the Iron Throne. And it's like that is where we start, and that is where the journey, the whole of this story, is about that fact and the unraveling of this ancient, patriarchal, really pretty corrupt, and dysfunctional system. Which, weirdly, is not that
dissimilar
far from
to where we are today.
Where we are now.
George said in one of the panels that he did that there is no character that's really good or evil, as opposed to Game of Thrones. That this one, there's a lot of gray area with these characters. Hmm. But in your personal opinion, who is the most evil and the most good in season one?
Oh wow!
God.
I think answering who's the most good might be an easier question than who's bad.
I think who's the most sort of good, good in inverted commas, but it would be Viserys? I would say Viserys.
Oh, of course, yeah. I was actually going to say Rhaenyra, but you're right, Viserys.
I would probably say Rhaenyra's very she's very low down in terms of
okay, so Viserys is, yeah.
But in terms of
most
who's
good.
Like a good guy, a good guy.
He's just an innocent who found himself in the wrong situation.
Yeah, it feels like
but,
he's a sort
oh,
of,
do you know?
He's an innocent.
Hightower. Rhys, he's the most evil.
Most evil.
He's the one plotting.
Oh,
Otto Hightower.
He's a nasty piece of work.
Yeah, he's the one.
Yeah, get him.
Splintering shields and ringing swords. A knight placed my heir upon the Iron Throne.
Your credits in the amount of projects that you've done between The Witcher, between Outlander, The Voice of Loki, over 100 credits as an actor, I think around 135. So where does this show fit in the pantheon of your career?
Yeah, no, well, this is a fantastic show. Yeah, I mean, I was a huge fan of the original. I knew Ryan Condal from two previous shows that we've worked on together. And we were both very keen to work together again. And we used to have lunch and actually talk about this. When it was not guaranteed at all, not greenlit, you know, there were a number of shows competing for the same spot. And we both had this wonderful kind of ambition to be able to see this come to fruition. And it is one, it's fabulous, especially for Ryan, but for me as well, to actually be a part of something that I've long wanted to be a part of.
Okay, so because you were sort of there at its inception, what about Ryan's vision and his ability to lead, do you think made George R. R. Martin sort of name him the successor to the Game of Thrones kingdom? Because he's kind of like the appointed king by George R. R. Martin.
I know. I mean, I don't know if Ryan's told you this. I'd hate to be sort of speaking out of turn, but when we were doing a pilot in New Mexico, we were in Santa Fe, and of course, George lives around there. And Ryan, and I love this about Ryan, he, massive fan, and he basically pursued George and said, you know, it'd be really great to sit down and have lunch. And they just became friends and became very, very sort of involved with each other and creatively. And here we have the result. And I just think that's the most wonderful story. That was 9 years ago that that happened.
Wow.
And so from that moment to this wonderful full experience that we're now having is down to that. And I think that's a great story.
So your character had served King Jaehaerys and King Viserys. Did you sort of delve into the backstory, and who do you think is the better leader between the two of them?
Well, much as I love Viserys, I think his predecessor was probably, I mean, the problem is, I mean, it's very difficult. He has a very, very difficult role. I mean, not Paddy, but Viserys.
And Paddy.
Paddy has a difficult role too, but, you know, in all sorts of ways. But Viserys, the way he even became king already placed him on a path of conflict, really. And that's what's so wonderful about the world that George created and the world that Ryan and Miguel are creating with the show, is that these have echoes in real history. These people that came to power somewhat reluctantly, somewhat by accident, tried to do their best, tried to do the right thing. And then there were these other forces at work that were trying to undermine them, or trying to, what they believed was, do the right thing. And, you know, so much of history is littered by people who felt they were doing the right thing and were really doing the wrong thing. And so, yeah, this fits really well into that. And we have the bonus of dragons, of course.
Well, I'm going to add one more contest into the equation. Who do you think better natural born leader, King Viserys or Jaime Frazier?
From the king of men. Natural born leader. Goodness me. That's a look, you know, Jamie Fraser doesn't have to deal with dragons. So, you know, come on, give the guy a break. Viserys is, he's got a lot on his plate. I mean, Jamie's just got the American War of Independence. So it's nothing compared with what Viserys has to deal with. So I think Viserys is doing really well. And I would say that because I'm Lord Commander of the Kingsguard.
And as commander, I mean, it seems like this is a show of ambition as well. There are people that don't start out ambitious, and then they become ambitious, and maybe it corrupts them, it corrupts their heart. Where do you fall in the line of this? Where does your character, because yours seems sort of the most selfless in a way from the get-go, but I don't know where it goes because I haven't read the books.
I am, I'm a morally upright individual, yes, I am, which is an unusual step for me in my career. And he's just somebody that sees things very simply, and also occupies a place in what is almost like a pseudo-religious order, the King's Guard, sort of reminiscent of the Knights Templar. You know, he abandons all kind of worldly delights. You know, there's no relationships for Harold. There's no money. There's nothing. There's just the Targaryens. No chair. Probably no bed. He's just devoted to them. So he's a very straight guy, and he has his opinions about everybody, But he tries his very best to keep those opinions to himself.
Just before I let you go, at the start of season one, who do you think is the rightful heir to the throne?
Oh, I think Rhaenyra. Yeah, definitely.
Rhaenyra.
Definitely. I do. I believe that she's the right choice. Yes. Wow. I endorse this message.